is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When you think back on your childhood summers, what are the memories that are most important or heartwarming? What were the best things you did when school was out? Play in the streams and woods, go to sleepaway camp, take a camping trip full of hilarious misadventures with the whole family, including Fido? What are you doing with your kids in the summertime? It takes a lot more planning to create the space for those lasting memories than you may have realized when you were a youngin'. Some camps fill up several months in advance, so you've got to be on the ball before the seed catalogs have even come out if you want to plant your child in one of those open spaces. And then you've got to make sure you've filled all the gaps between the end of one school year and the beginning of the next. What are you going to do with those 2 weeks in July that you just can't cover? Can you take some vacation time yourself? Can your partner? Can you set up a rotating adventure camp with the other parents in your area so your kids get to have unstructured playtime, but you don't have to take 6 weeks off? It takes a lot of careful coordination. And let's not forget money. Summertime can be really expensive, pretty tough if your budget is tight. So we thought we'd allow you the space today on the show to commiserate, but also to crowdsource. What are the cool things you're doing with your kids or have done in the past? What creative ways have you come up with to afford your kids in the summertime? And what leaves you still tugging your hair in frustration? Here to help us cover the waterfront is Jocelyn Adams, co-owner of Burlington, Vermont Mom's Blog, and Allison Novak, managing editor of Kids Vermont, a monthly hard copy and online magazine. It's a pleasure to have you both on the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, any challenges that I missed in that introduction to finding stuff to do for your kids all summer, Allison?
I think you kind of covered the bases there. Yeah.
And your kids are in this age group, right? They're school age, and so you do have to figure out stuff to do with them that is not public school.
Yeah. So my kids are 6 and 9. So this is actually the first year that both of them are in school. Luckily, my husband is a teacher, so we do have a lot of coverage in the summer, but. Logistically, yeah, I found it really tricky because we do need some coverage and signing them up for camps. You know, a lot of camps have ages 6 to 8 for one group and 9 to 12 for another group. So sometimes, you know, you can't sign them for the same camp. Also, you know, they have different interests.
So what are you doing with your kids?
So I've signed them up for a bunch of camps and we'll also take a vacation and spend a lot of family time. So, there's some camps that are offered through schools and parks and rec departments. So I've signed my kids up for a week or two of those. And what's nice about those is, you know, often kids will have friends in those because they're, you know, in their community. And so you don't have to worry about, is my child going to have someone to, you know, buddy up with?
Yeah, because for some kids, switching things every week or 2 weeks is, you know, some children want stability. They want the same thing all summer. And even if you could go to, you know, Dragons camp 1 week and farm camp the next, that's just a lot of movement. And some kids really don't like that kind of upheaval in their summer schedule.
It's true. I think you have to really know your kid. And, I think there also are really cool enrichment opportunities. So, like, my daughter's really into theater. So every summer we sign her up for a Very Merry theater camp. And, like, those are just amazing opportunities to kind of really explore interests that they can't explore during the school year.
And Jocelyn, you also have two kids, but your kids are younger, so you're not quite at this stage yet?
They are younger. So I have a 2-year-old and then a 2-week-old.
Yes, and so the 2-week-old probably not going to sleepaway camp this year.
No, he's attached to me, literally.
But you also work with a lot of moms and a lot of dads, but you look at a lot of families in Vermont who are trying to go through this, and you were asking some of them about what they do in the summertime. So, you know, what are you hearing about?
Oh, absolutely. So we are hearing that sometimes it's not even just about the camps. It's just trying to figure out childcare at all. And so camps can be really expensive, although I have heard that parks and rec camps are a little bit more affordable and their hours are sometimes better. So they'll cover from 9 to 5:30, which is much of the workday, where some of the more specialized camps end at 3:30 or 4 o'clock, causing parents to have to leave work early. Or we were discussing before the broadcast started is that a lot of camps also want to show off what your kids have been doing all week. So on Fridays, often around 12 or 1 o'clock, you have to leave work to go see what your child has been doing, like either a performance or what they've been creating. And I know from our team, I was hearing that there's some creative things that some child cares child care providers actually do, where if your child comes for after school, it maybe it's, say, $15 a day normally. They'll charge $18 a day the whole school year and summer, so that when they start coming for the summer break or for winter break or whatever break, they that it's not all of a sudden like you're being like doubled. The price of it's not being doubled. It's instead it's being across the whole year. But in general, I also was hearing from some team members that one of our writers, she's actually going to be teaching at a drama camp, but because she has no childcare, she's paying for her two children to attend the drama camp to cover the hours. And so people are depending on family. They're also taking off parts of the day. So mom may take off the morning and the dad may take off the afternoon so that they don't both miss an entire day of work. Or they're depending on neighbors or just trying to find a childcare spot or find camps, which I've heard from so many people that March is especially the time that, that people go crazy. They're, you know, they have spreadsheets. They're trying to figure out like, okay, so I have this week to this week, and then how do I do this week and that week? It gets a little crazy.
Yeah, and March, you know, by March you would be crazy because Allison, you have to start looking for these camps sometimes in January, December. I mean, it really is like pre-seed.
There's
catalog.
Some camps, like some pretty like popular camps where you have to get in a lottery. Shelburne Farms is one where in February the lottery, you have to enter the lottery. So, but you know, for the procrastinators, I wouldn't totally, you know, be panicking now because there are still camps that have spots even now when school's out in 2 weeks. So, I think there'd still be places to send your kids, but it might not be your first pick.
All right, listeners, I do want to know, what are you doing with your kids this summer and how are you coming up with the money to pay for it? Did you start in January or are you now thinking, oh, right, summer, I've got to do something with them? And how are you shuffling your life around to get your kids from activity A to activity B? You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Carrie in Arlington says, it cost more money to put my girls in camps for a week than I make in that week of working. Kristen in Georgia Center is a big fan of the art camps at the Davis Studio. Donna in Barton says, we used to go in the woods all day and build forts. There are plenty of wooded areas in Vermont. And Jocelyn, a lot of people have memories of just sort of unstructured playtime, and it seemed so easy. It didn't ever seem like any parents were struggling. Do you think that it's harder now because of family dynamics and times have changed? Or were adults today, when they were kids, just not aware of the juggling their parents were doing?
I think it might be a little bit of both, but I do think that now we're in a position where you either have single parents or you have two working parents in the home. And so maybe they'd like their children to be out in the woods playing all the time, but it's probably not appropriate for a 7 or an 8 year old to be home alone from 9 to 5. So they have to figure out childcare. They need to have an adult that is watching them. And I know that one of our writers actually pointed out that she thinks it's a misconception that a lot of people think that summer breaks are for farmers, were put in place for farmers, but it was actually for more well-off rich families to be able to take vacations. And so it's actually like a burden on working families, and it continues to be. For her in particular, she has two children. They're a two-parent working home, and they only have one vehicle. So to get two kids to two different camps at the same time that start and end at the same time, it's just really hard. But she loves summer. She loves vacation. She loves that she gets some quality time with her kids. But she just wishes it wasn't so crazy and that there was an easier way to do it.
Allison, I see you nodding. And also, I mean, that question of budgeting, no matter what you're trying to do, I mean, unless you have a sort of unlimited budget and you're smart enough to start in January, it's really hard. I mean, camps are expensive. I mean, we had Carrie say it costs more to put my girls in camps for a week than I make in that week of working.
Yep. I think you have to shop around. I think there, you know, the cost of camps really runs the gamut. So I think if you start early and do your research, you can probably find some more affordable camps. I do think the more enrichment-oriented ones, art, computer coding, things like that tend to be pricier. One kind of interesting suggestion is my daughter really wanted to take a sewing camp, and that's all she wanted to learn to do for her 9th birthday is sew. And so that was the birthday gift my parents ended up giving her, a camp, sewing camp for 1 week. And so those are some creative ways that you could still maybe pack in some of that enrichment, asking for those things as gifts.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about strategies. And again, I want to invite our listeners, if you have strategies that you use for getting through the summer, we'd love to hear them. The rest of the parents out there would love some suggestions. So you can go to vpr.net or you can call 1-800-639-2211. And Allison, you mentioned, you know, maybe asking for gifts from the grandparents that a week at summer camp instead of, you know, something else that might be a big gift. But also you can ask for grandparents or, you know, pull in the family ties and say, don't you want to come to Vermont for a week?
Yeah. I think that that's an awesome idea. I also think buddying up with a family. So maybe you'd sign your kid up for the same camp as a friend and you would share the carpooling. So you'd share, one of you would drop off and one of you would pick up. And maybe if you have to work a full day and the camp ends at 3, that friend would take your child to their house for a couple hours and it would buy you a little more work time. So I think things like that can work. You have to kind of think creatively like that.
And Jocelyn, what about the idea of, you know, adventure camp at somebody else's house each week? So everybody takes a week off in your little friend group and, you know, you're at the Smiths 1 week and the Joneses the next week. And it is sort of that unstructured playtime, but it's a different parent sort of corralling the bunch of kids.
Absolutely. And I think that parents do that. They do that for the summer, but they also do that just for school vacations, like shorter ones, the one in February or the one in April. And I know that I actually do that for Caroline, is that sometimes I'll switch with friends. You know, I'll take them for the afternoon, one afternoon so that my friend can do something, and then she'll take them a different afternoon so I can get something done. I mean, I think it goes back to it takes a village, and it does. It's really hard in society, I think, sometimes if you're not feeling like you're keyed into other people and to your friend, your children's friends or your own friends having kids that are also friends with your children. But I feel like school age always seems like it's a lot better just because it's a natural thing. Like, when Caroline is in first grade, hopefully she will have a group of friends and I'll know the parents of those friends and we can trade off like that.
But she's your 2-year-old.
She's my 2-year-old, yes.
Yeah. You know, it can also be hard, though, if you're a kind of parent who just doesn't want to do that. You know, there are some parents who, look, you're just either genetically it doesn't work for you. Like, taking care of a lot of kids is not something that you would find joyful or something that you feel secure in your ability to do. And so, you know, then you sort of are trying to rely on a group of parents but not being willing to be one yourself in that group. And I imagine that would be hard, even if you do know your friend's parents.
That would be hard if
that's friends' parents.
I think what's nice about summertime activities, though, is, you know, kids can kind of entertain themselves, especially at the school age, for hours. So if, you know, you're dropping your kid off at the beach, you know, ostensibly the kids could be playing in the sand for a couple hours while the mom or dad reads the newspaper. So it's not such a huge onus sometimes in the summer, because I think kids can kind of while away the afternoon doing things and not need a lot of parental support when they get a little older.
Let's go to Jamie, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you, everyone. My name is Jamie, and I am the aquatics director at the Greater Burlington YMCA, and I'm listening on the conversation. It's wonderful and healthy conversations about camp. I just wanted to chime in and share about, you know, the why, and we're all about finding fun and healthy outlets for families. And as a mother and now a grandmother, it's personally important to me that the wise message gets out about encouraging families to balance their fun and their safety for the summer, particularly around the water. You know, we're surrounded by beautiful rivers and lakes, and it's so important for families to look at swimming and water safety the same way that they do of teaching their children to, you know, like wash their hands before they eat or looking both ways before they cross the road. And, you know, it's so simple to teach them that, but often we don't think of safety around the water as important. So we're trying to get that message out there and educate families in that manner.
And Jamie, you know, when you talk about that aquatic safety, I mean, a lot of kids can get swimming lessons when they're young, but others don't have them. And you're right, it is difficult for people, you know, and Allison was talking about, you know, you get a whole group of kids and there are going to be a lot of different swimming levels and abilities in that. And you may not know how well your kids' friends can swim when you, you know, get them for the day at the beach.
Yeah, that's correct, and it's so important to making sure that parents are being attentive, even though there may be a...
Oh, looks like we lost Jamie there, but anyway, point being, you know, swimming, important to know, and important to know the skill level of the kids that you're hanging out with. You can share your thoughts with us, 1-800-639-2211. We'll get another one in here from Emily in Marlow, New Hampshire. Hi, Emily, you're on.
Hey there. Yes, my name is Emily Hughes, and I'm just calling from Croak Expeditions. We're a nonprofit wilderness school over in Marlow, and we've got kids all over our campus right now. And I was just thinking about the affordability. I think that's really key for any family. And I just wanted to share that we offer these amazing wilderness programs where kids are going out in the woods of Vermont, paddling the rivers, eating organic food and drinking good, clean water, and just having a wonderful time in the woods together. And people can perceive that this would be a really expensive experience, but every family we recognize has really different needs and abilities financially, and so we offer a really great scholarship program, and if anyone was interested, we would always be willing to help with a family in a very real way. We're so grateful to be neighbors with Vermont. We're here in New Hampshire, and I'm just glad this is a conversation because it's so helpful to families to help share ideas and things like that. So thank you for having this conversation.
And Emily, do you still have any room? I mean, that's one of the questions is for parents at the tail end of May who are trying to figure things out. Or is a camp like yours still have openings?
Great question. We have so much room for teenagers. So 13 to 19, we have these amazing expeditions for 2 to 3 weeks. We have, you know, students who go up and paddle the Des Moines River, which is the Canadian expedition, for 3 weeks. We have students going to Katahdin and Baxter State Park in Maine for 3 weeks doing extensive rock climbing and whitewater canoeing. These are programs that still have availability and totally have scholarship support as well.
Emily, thanks for calling. I appreciate hearing from you. We got a note from George who says, my children went through the Green Mountain Conservation Camp run by the state. It's reasonably priced, well-run, and a great opportunity for children to learn a variety of skills. The camp has two sites, Woodbury and Castleton, with many great kids and counselors. And we have a note from Kevin who says, I run a company called 802 Reptiles. I provide education programs, birthday parties, library programs, events at summer camps, and such. As a traveling reptile program located in Colchester, we focus on creating an environment that not only teaches our guests about exotic reptiles, but at the same time allows a hands-on experience for the memory of a lifetime. Nice to hear from people who have their own organizations here, but also just to think about the variety of things that you can do with your kids or your kids can do in the summertime. Boy, I mean, wouldn't we all like to be able to have as many adventures as these kids have potential opportunities to have? We're going to keep talking about that. We're going to look at some of the other fun things to do in Vermont in the summer. We're talking about the struggles of trying to provide care for your children all summer, especially if you're in a household with working parents or working family members and don't have the ability to take time off. You can share your thoughts with us, your strategies, your suggestions, your struggles. 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're talking about what to do with your kids all summer. Camps fill up months in advance, parental vacation days aren't always all that flexible, and figuring out how to pay for 3 months' worth of highly engaging, educational, and safe programming that will surely set your little one on the path to future greatness while also honoring her need for unstructured play and self-motivation is... well, a challenge. So we're using the Hive Mind to give parents some ideas today. We're talking with Allison Novak, managing editor of Kids Vermont, a monthly hard copy and online magazine, and with Jocelyn Adams, co-owner of Burlington, Vermont Mom's Blog. And with you, 1-800-639-2211 is our number if you'd like to share your strategies, the best things you've done with your kids. You can even share a memory of the best thing that you did when you were a kid and how you plan or hope to have your kids have a similar experience. Again, 1-800-639-2211, or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Catherine in Hoosick Falls, New York says, taking a day trip to King Arthur Flower. I wish I could afford camp there for my son, but King Arthur, here we come. Jessica in Milton says, many libraries have summer reading programs where if the kids read X amount of books, they get a free gift or participate in an end of summer readers party. Elizabeth says, my children are now 21 and 24. After years of struggling to find the right camp for my kids, one child with autism and special needs, it all came down to one simple rule. For school-aged kids, 12 and under, they have to have group singing. Sounds silly, but it works. For some reason, any camp that incorporates group singing values summer, free spirit, and all children in general. And let's go to John, calling in from Newbury. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Yes, how are you? Hi. Yeah, I would love to chime in. My kids have left the nest. It's been a long time since, but really wanted to chime in for a great family activity that does not involve great expense. It ticks off so many boxes for teachable moments, family, togetherness, planning time, and that's to simply take a hike. We lived pretty close back in the day to the Connecticut River. We would go across and climb Mount Cardigan and the wonderful views. But again, it was just such a great time for family at very little expense. And it's something that to this day I think that they comment on, thankfully. I think it's really given them a lot of great models for, looking ahead to raising their own families. So that's what I have to say.
John, thanks for saying it. Thanks for sharing your memories with us of what you did with your kids. You know, that idea, whether you have the time off or it's just things you're doing on the weekends with your kids, summertime is so fabulous in Vermont, and we wait for it all year long, so we might as well enjoy it while we've got it. Allison, what are some of the things that you found that families can do that are summertime adventures that if you have the ability to go do these with your children, you really shouldn't miss them?
Yep. Well, Vermont State Parks actually has this really cool Venture Vermont Challenge where you can go on their website and download a scavenger hunt, which has all sorts of cool challenges like whittling a marshmallow stick or identifying different plants or taking a picture of a certain type of frog. And you get points. And once you earn 250, you send in your form and you get free park admission for the next year to all Vermont State Parks. So that's a really kind of cool way to explore the outdoors with your family, but also kind of have a purpose. In Kids Vermont, we write about different day trips that families can take. We call them daycations. And so we've written about everything from, going to Aust-Able Chasm in New York to the Granby Zoo in Canada to the Maritime Museum in Ferrisburg, the Alberg Dunes. There's just so many places. And I've lived in Vermont for 12 years, and I still feel like there's so many places I haven't gone yet with my family that I'm excited to go this summer and beyond. So
we had Jessamine West, one of the librarians in Vermont, on the show last week, and she handed over to me a library's passport, too, that all the libraries in Vermont are doing a passport, and you can get a stamp when you go to see one of the libraries in Vermont. I know the independent booksellers in Vermont are doing that as well, so you can get prizes if you've gone to all the indie bookstores. So there are things like that that will help you sort of take a tour and feel like you're on a little bit of a scavenger hunt in some ways.
Yeah, kids love scavenger hunts, even if it's in your own backyard. Setting one up for your kids. I think there's just something really enticing about scavenger hunts.
Jocelyn, what do you think?
So we also at Burlington Vermont Moms Blog also think about day trips. And I know one of the things that my family loves to do, especially when we have family up and visiting, is just essentially taking a road and going down it. So like Route 7. So going from Burlington to Middlebury, there are so many awesome places that you can hit. A lot of it's eating, some of it's drinking, some of it's doing tours, but it's just
a lot of it's creamies.
Creamies, cookie love. But Vermont has just so many different things that we offer. And it's almost like being a like you're not from Vermont and exploring, so that it's finding something new. And one of the things that we also do at the blog is we're in the midst of scheduling what we call our summer park hop. And so it's a mix of town, city, and state parks through mostly Chittenden County, Lamoille, Franklin, Grand Isle, Washington, and Addison counties. We try to hit at least one in each of those counties, 12 weeks long, where it's really informal. We'll put up a schedule of where we'll be each week, and just to get parents out of the house. And sometimes sometimes with the summer, it's great to be with your children, but it's also nice to know that you're still connecting with other adults. So knowing that, oh, I can go explore this new park, but I know that I'll be there with other people, and that I'll have other people to talk with or like sit under the tree with while my kids are playing and maybe making some new friends. But that's one thing that we've seen a need for that we're trying to put out there as well.
Cool. And listeners, if you have suggestions, again, 1-800-639-2211 is our number, or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Josh in Burlington says, this year we decided to forego camps and instead include our daughter in more of our day-to-day as we're building a new house in the country. However, for next year, we have signed our daughter up for sleepaway camp as an alternative to all of these day camps. We're curious of any thoughts regarding sleepaway camps that your guests may have. And we haven't talked about that, but for a lot of kids and a lot of adults now who remember their childhood years, those were formative experiences, not always positive. I mean, a lot of kids have memories of sleepaway camp terror or that feeling of homesickness. Yeah. So what are your thoughts, Allison? I mean, your kids are at that age where you could start to think about it.
Yeah, they're not quite ready for it yet, but it's definitely on my mind because in Kids Vermont, we have a camp directory where we have all sorts of camps, and a lot of them are sleepaway camps. And there's a lot in Vermont. I think in terms of signing kids up for sleepaway camps, that's probably something you start thinking about the summer before, like responder. And, you know, you want to do a lot of research into those because, again, you're sending your kids away for, you know, 4 weeks or however long. And so you want to make sure you feel really comfortable, maybe take a visit, talk to other parents who've sent their kids there.
We got a note from Blythe in Rutland who says, I'm a huge fan of camp, especially overnight camps. It instills some independence while teaching cooperation. Camping with me is just like living with me, but without walls. Camp is meeting strangers and making it work. The rest of the summer, lots of time outside with nets, magnifying glasses, jars, and books, and liberal amounts of sunscreen and bug spray. And we got a note from Jill who emailed in to say, we start working on the camp schedule for my two daughters, 6 and 11, in February, and we cover it with a combination of grandparent time, vacation time, and camps. This year, when I was pitching different camp ideas to my older daughter, she said she just wanted to go to library camp. And that's when she came up with the idea of a Harry Potter camp. So for any listeners in the central Vermont area, Potterheads Camp will take place at Twinfield Union High School in Marshfield, Vermont, from June 20th to 24th, 9 to 4. This is a new kid-led camp focused on all things Harry Potter, potions, wand-making, spell-making, Quidditch, etc. Again, it's Potterheads Camp and Twinfield Union High School in Marshfield the week of June 20th. Let's go to Tad, who's calling in from Northfield. Hi, Tad. Go ahead.
Hi there. I have been, for the last 4 years, putting away money in my camp funds for my grandchildren. I have four of them, and every Christmas they each get $100, and for birthdays they get $200, and that includes their parents. So they don't get any other presents, but they do have a camp fund that by the time they're 8 or 9 or 10 or 11, they'll have some actual money in there for them.
So, Tad, what do you think your grandkids are going to do with their camp funds? What do you think? What kinds of camps?
Oh, I have no idea. My daughter lives in Belgrade, Serbia, and my son lives in the Charlotte area, and I have no idea what the kids are going to be doing.
Well, cool idea, and you started it early, so you know that's right. They will have quite a good chunk of change in there by the time they're ready to go to camps. We got a note from PRH who says, my childhood summers were mostly spent at my grandmother's house about a mile from Lake Michigan in Milwaukee. My fun activities included playing with my friends on her block, swimming in the lake and at a nearby pool, visiting the zoo and museum downtown, attending an occasional Braves game with my great aunts at the old county stadium in the days of Warren Spahn and Eddie Matthews, and fishing with my uncle. Boring. I generally walked or took the bus, and I was pretty much unsupervised for most of it. I still have very fond memories of that time and of the city. And let's go to Bridget in St. Albans. Hi, Bridget. Go right ahead.
Hey, Jay. How's it going?
Great.
I've got a couple suggestions for up in the Franklin County area for people. I know sometimes it's hard for us in the northern part of the state to get out to all these central Vermont places. So the two that I've got that I love are the Ed Weed Fish Hatchery that's up in Grand Isle. And it's a great spot where they're raising trout and salmon to release back into lakes and streams here in Lake Champlain Basin area. And what's wonderful is you can walk through and you can feed the fish. And it's also a really great spot for birding as well. So it's kind of like double for me. And the other spot is the Missisquoi National Wildlife Refuge. If you go to the visitor center on Taver Road, you can pick up a backpack that's got all kinds of goodies in it, from hand lenses to field guides and things like that. And they have some wonderful trails that are really super kid-friendly. We like the one right at the visitor center because there's boardwalks and water and fields and ponds to walk by. And you can grab that backpack to kind of add to the fun.
Bridget, thanks for the suggestions. Good suggestions for up in the St. Albans area for people looking for things to do with their kids. And I can remember childhoods just loving to go to the fish hatchery down in Addison County, which, I mean, it seems like such a strange place to take kids, but it was so cool to see all those fish. And yeah, you can, you know, buy the little pellets and throw them into the fish. Jocelyn, other thoughts that you have about summers and parents? And, you know, you were saying even if you're a stay-at-home parent, summertime can still be challenging for people. So it's not just working parents who are trying to figure this out.
Definitely. And then there's also the work at home parents who work maybe part time. But I mean, the summer days can feel long. And even if your children aren't in school yet, there's a lot of really great free programming that happens during the school year to make sure that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 year olds are getting really good enrichment activities. But a lot of that also ends during the summer months or isn't as often. And so I feel like it's sort of a struggle for all parents. It's not just working parents. I think that the summer can be amazing and fun and all the memories that people are talking about. But at the same time, the days can feel long and making sure you're feeling like your kids are getting enough.
All right. So bottom line, you're not alone if you're feeling
right.
Like this is a stressful time. Jocelyn Adams is co-owner of the Burlington, Vermont Moms Blog. Allison Novak is managing editor of Kids Vermont, a monthly magazine in Vermont. Thanks very much to both of you. Really appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Coming up, a new report from the National Academies of Science said there's no health risk to eating food made from genetically modified ingredients. We'll talk with the lead researcher on the report about what his group found and why he wants all of you to go read the 400-page report for yourself. Maybe that's what you can do this summer. That's next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. GMOs, genetically modified organisms, are a controversial topic in food. Supporters of GMO crops say they boost the food supply and lower the costs of food when seeds are engineered with resistance to pests. Critics of GMOs say the foods themselves are bad for human health and the environment. And when the public is trying to determine GMO food, good or bad, there are multitudes of conflicting studies and reports to draw from that bolster one side of the debate or another. This month, a report from the National Academy of Sciences sought to clarify the debate. A team of researchers pored over data from previous studies and summarized it in a substantial report that's written for the public and policymakers to digest. We spoke with Fred Gould, the North Carolina State University scientist who chaired the committee, about what his team found.
We were 20 people who worked for 2 years on this, and we came up with our own assessment. But deep in this is a 400-page report with over 1,000 references to papers, both pro and con and in between, and we wanted to make sure that people could access it. And there's a place in that report where we had received 700 inquiries or comments from the public, and we tried to address those. And you can click on any one of those comments and see how we responded to those comments, and you can decide for yourself.
You know, I guess not surprisingly, though, since the report has come out, you've been both applauded and criticized from people on all different sides. Depending on where you're looking, if you're not a person who's actually reading the report, you could be very confused about what the report's conclusions are. So what's your assessment?
There are a few things. One is that we start off by saying that to make sweeping generalizations about genetically engineered crops is impossible because some genetically engineered crops make them resistant to herbicides. So you can spray specific herbicides. And if the herbicide that you can now spray is dangerous, well, that's a problem, right? But, and then you can conclude that's a bad genetically engineered product. But if you have another genetically engineered product that increases the beta carotene content of rice, and this could help people who have vitamin A deficiency ward off blindness, well, maybe you'd see that as a positive. But you can't conclude from either one of those that all GE crops are either good or bad. It depends on the specifics. So that's a major thing that, you know, we try to emphasize here, is that people try to, you know, do this broad brush approach, and that it's becoming less and less tenable. It's also becoming less and less technically tenable to distinguish between genetically engineered crops and conventionally bred crops. So I use the analogy that in 1996, when genetically engineered crops first came out, you know, at that time, the analogy is if you had a laptop computer and a cell phone at that time, it would be pretty clear to you what you'd want to use your cell phone for and what you'd want to use your laptop for. But today, if you have a cell phone, it can probably do all the things that your 1996 laptop can do, as well as what your cell phone could do then. So in 1996, there was a very clear distinction between genetically engineered crops and conventionally bred crops, in that genetically engineered crops were a specific thing where you had a transgene, a gene from something other than that plant that was put into the plant using genetic engineering techniques. And the conventionally bred crops were mostly crops that were made by crossing different plants of the same species, although people used radiation and mutagenesis that was still considered conventional breeding. Today, we're in a different situation where people who are doing genetically engineering of crops are sometimes just changing a single amino acid in one variety of crops to match what that amino acid base pairs would be in another variety of that same crop. And people who use mutagenesis breeding could, using other genomic approaches, come up with a crop that was herbicide resistant to the same herbicide that the genetically engineered crop was resistant. So you wind up with a blurring of that distinction. And we want to make that point because we want to focus people on the fact that you could make a genetically engineered crop that is very different than anything that existed before, and that would be very novel and important to analyze very carefully. But if you made a change using genetic engineering that just made variety A have a similar allele or gene to variety B, that's pretty different. The other thing that we point out is that not only did the techniques for genetically engineering a crop change since 1996, so did the techniques for analyzing the genetically engineered crops and conventionally engineered crops change. So the FDA asks companies to submit data on 60 different characteristics of the new crop that they want to put on the market. With the new high-throughput technologies, you can analyze thousands of characteristics to get basically a fingerprint of the new crop and a fingerprint of the crop before that to see if there really are any intended or unintended changes. So the focus should, you know, we say at least, should be more on the actual characteristics of the plant, not on the genes that were changed, because change in a small number of genes can lead to a big change in the characteristics of a plant, and big changes in the genes can lead to a small change. So really, it's what you're eating that matters, right? So you want to analyze what you're eating.
One of the other things that your study found was a lack of proof of detriment to human health. And that's not the first time we've heard that. There have been many studies that have shown that GMO crops don't negatively impact human health. So when you were looking at that, was it just to confirm the data that you were trying to get to that point, or to see if there was something else that you could show people?
Yeah, so actually, you know, we knew that there were all these studies out there, but we also knew that there were studies out that claimed that there were effects. So we started out at the beginning in our committee to move ourselves to really reexamine the data. And if you look through the one chapter on health effects, there's over 200 references in that chapter, because we went back to the initial literature and looked at those studies. But also, we did a first look at the epidemiology in human populations. So since 1996, people in the U.S. and Canada have been eating genetically engineered crops, but people in the U.K. and in Western Europe and the EU have not been. So are there any differences in chronic diseases in these two different groups? And we went through that data and didn't find any differences. And again, all that information is in the report, and you can click on specific questions and take a look at those graphs and data for yourself.
When you add that at the end, this idea that people can go and look for themselves, I'm interested because, not that you sound defensive in a pejorative way, but my hunch is that you get a lot of pushback on specifically that area of the report.
Well, we get pushback on all areas of the report, but I'd like to be open about this in the sense that often people are given these kind of authoritative reports, and we'd like our report to be the beginning of a conversation, not the end of it. I'd love to have, you know, people have book clubs, right, and they read books and go through them. You can go through our chapter on health effects and discuss it with your friends.
You know, I can't imagine a lot of book groups in America choosing this particular 400-page report, but I like the idea.
You know, let's say choose that one chapter or choose a piece. You know, people talk about it all the time, but they don't have access for themselves to the information. And I understand that maybe that's less interesting than a novel, but you know, you just go into a grocery store and you overhear a conversation about people talking about these things, but we want them at least to have the access to the information.
So again, with the understanding that you're not trying to put a stamp on this is the truth about genetically engineered crops, you did find that in some cases you may be seeing an increase in certain weeds while you may be seeing a decrease in certain insects. And I'd love for you as an entomologist to talk about what you're seeing as the effects on insects.
Right. Well, that is true. That's my area, is the entomology area. And what's interesting is, you know, you could argue that we should all do organic agriculture, but that's not being done. And there's a lot of insecticide being sprayed, and it's called broad-spectrum insecticides because it kills the pests and natural enemies at the same time. The protein that's being put into the plants comes from Bacillus thuringiensis, a bacteria that was used by organic farmers. You know, I mean, I don't want to defend, you know, like whether the company should be doing this or not. But the bottom line is that when you have a corn plant out that has this toxin from the BT bacteria, it is very specific to a few pests and is not going to have as big an impact on the natural enemies. So when people survey fields that were conventionally bred crops treated with insecticides versus the ones with the genetically engineered crops, people typically find more natural enemies in the genetically engineered crops. The resistance issue is a big thing for an entomologist because we have worked hard to try to get regulations passed to not overuse those crops so that resistance wouldn't evolve. And the EPA has regulations, and it seems to me that when they're followed, the pests haven't evolved resistance. With the herbicides, there's been so much use of one herbicide that it's not surprising that the weeds are evolving resistance to them.
And this is glyphosate?
That's glyphosate, yes.
So that could be a problem moving forward.
Well, that is a problem now.
Uh-huh.
In North Carolina, where I live, this is a problem for farmers. But an issue to bring up is, of course, if we never had genetically engineered crops with resistance to glyphosate, the farmers in North Carolina would probably still be using herbicides that are more problematic to the environment and human health than the glyphosate is. So it's a mixed bag. And again, in the report, we didn't find evidence of health effects of the currently engineered crops, and we didn't find real environmental disruption from the currently engineered crops. So, I mean, one thing that, of course, this led to with the health effects is that we said we didn't see health effects. And there's these issues about labeling that, of course, come up. And the FDA keeps saying, oh, we can't label this because it's not part of our mandate. If there's nothing substantially different between two kinds of food, we don't label it. And, you know, we say in the report we didn't see that difference, but we also say in our report that there are lots of reasons why governments label specific kinds of foods. And in the U.S., the FDA does have limits on its authority, but state and national governments don't. So there have been laws passed for mandatory labeling on things like country of origin of products, whether something is artificial flavoring or natural flavoring. So the committee makes a comment that based on health issues, we don't see a reason for labeling. But based on other reasons, it's up to society to make those decisions.
Fred Gould is a professor of entomology at North Carolina State University and chairman of the committee that just produced the big new report on GMO crops from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Fred, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
You heard Gould repeatedly encourage you to read and explore the data and citations. We have a link to the National Academy of Sciences report on the effects of GMO on our website, vpr.net. Click on today's Vermont edition. Now that the legislative session has ended for the biennium, the focus turns to the statewide political races. Tomorrow on the program, we'll hear from a panel of the state's top political reporters to discuss the top-of-the-ticket races. Send your questions or thoughts on the governor's and lieutenant governor's races to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen to the show tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen. Liam Connors directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.